Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
And I'm John Mayer. And today we're excited to be joined by Hugh McCutcheon. Hugh led the men's indoor team to the gold medal in 2008 and the silver medal with the women in 2012. And he's now the head coach of one of the top college volleyball programs in the nation at the University of Minnesota. Hugh, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Well, before we get into our topic, I wanted to first thank you for helping us out and sending in some audio for our tribute show on Carl McGowan. If anyone hasn't heard that episode, please go back and listen so you can hear the huge effect Carl's had on so many people and so many coaches. So thanks so much for helping out with that. I thought it came out really good.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's profound, the influence Carl had, no question.
Yeah, he's I think touched a lot of people in volleyball and outside of volleyball. So to get into our topic, we wanted to talk about team culture and specifically how a coach can build a sustainable culture of excellence. And I'm wondering if you'd mind starting talking out about some of your failures or some of your mistakes that you've made, maybe in your early years or even recent years, when attempting to implement a culture that you envisioned.
I think culture, of course, is very easy to talk about. But the reality is that it's a much more kind of nebulous thing. It's really about, in my opinion, you know, the goals, the values, the motives that are driving a particular group of people, and how those get, translated into action and interaction, and with that, you know, if you're talking about, you know, mistakes along the way, I think as you look to build a team, there are a few things that you need to put in place, probably concurrently. And part of that is if you're going to try to change the culture, or if you're at least looking to affect it in some way, you know, one of the things I tell people all the time is that coaches are salespeople first, and then we get to be change agents, but you've got to get the buy-in, right? You've got to sell it. And to get the buy-in, I guess you need, one, to be selling a product that you believe in. And two, I think you have to be consistent, in that delivery of whatever that message is and in the actions that support that. So I'm not sure I can reference, hey, there was this one time where I said to this athlete this thing, or there was this one time we should have fallen out of a tree and caught each other and we didn't, and it really screwed it up. I can't give you any stories like that. What I can say, though, is that this idea of cultural shift is really, you know, if we talk about the science and the art of coaching, this is more kind of on the qualitative side than it is on the quantitative. So to change any culture, you've got to have some buy-in, right? You've got to have people believe that the different methodology that you're proposing, or the different cultural structure that you're trying to implement, actually has merit. Otherwise, no one's going to really shift to do anything, because change is hard and we all like being comfortable.
So then what does that buy-in look like? What's your sales pitch?
Well, there's two parts to it. One of the things about kind of principle-driven methods is that they're self-evident. You know, if we're talking about the biomechanics of our sport, then, you know, it turns out that maintaining the integrity of the straight line when you're hitting allows you to hit with more power and range. So that works. On the cultural side of things, you know, I also think that the standards of excellence, the commitment to work, the commitment to learning, the ability to embrace competition, and so on, all of those things matter, but they also need to work relative to all of the stakeholders being able to achieve whatever it is they're looking to achieve. So you can't say, hey, we're going to change the culture and then go out and lose, you know, 30 matches in a row. and think that you're going to get a whole lot of buy-in. You know, you have to be able to affect behavioral change in terms of technique and systems. And woven into that, you have to also, I think, be able to start to build the culture out of that. I don't think they're two separate things. I think they end up being kind of connected.
Hmm. So, sorry, I want to step back to, it's kind of outside of culture, but I really like that reference of integrity of a straight line helps us attack the ball a little bit better. And both Billy and I are trying to attack a little better on the beach. So how do we keep that integrity? How do we get our biomechanics in line?
In my experience, I've found that the whole mechanics of attacking are, you know, incremental, but they're also sequential. And what I mean by that is, you know, if we've got some good footwork, then we can get good arms, you know, double arm lift. And if we've got good double arm lift, then we can get in a good loaded position ready to hit. And if we get that, then we can unload and we can hit with range and do all the things that we want to do. But if our feet aren't right, then we can't have good arms. And if arms aren't right, we can't have good load and so on and so forth. So I always like to start working on attacking from the ground up and look at your approach, the spacing, the timing, and then build into the way you're using your arms and then, of course, the mechanics at the end of it.
Sorry, I love this stuff. Now I'm into it. So we start from the ground up. Does that also mean an order of our four steps? Are we starting with the first step first?
Sure. Yeah. As I said, incremental and sequential, at least in my experience. And most people, when they talk about attacking, want to get all over, you know, whatever, arm swing and wrist snap or whatever it is. But I want to start with feet and then kind of work our way up from there.
Going back to team culture, can you take us through what your team culture looks like now at UM and maybe what's different or changed from previous teams you've coached?
Sure. You know, one of the things I'm experiencing with this particular group that we have right now is that after a few years of building this to get things where I thought the principles and the actions and the interactions and all that stuff were, aligned. Seeing it in action, it's been a pleasure to be in the gym. And I say that relative to, you know, we have the things that we believe are important. So our athletes are working hard. They're very engaged in the process of learning. They're embracing the moment of competition. They're helping each other. There's all kinds of great exchanges going on. And you know, the volleyball is pretty good too. And so it's just, great to be in that, what I think, a high functioning space is. I really commend our athletes for their work and the way that's being translated in terms of the behaviors that are supporting the hard work they're doing.
And how do you know if they are engaged in the process of learning? Like you said, is there cues that you pick up on, or how can you tell that they are engaged?
Well, yeah, you monitor progress. And if they're not getting better, then clearly they're not engaged. Or if they don't take on feedback and try to make changes, if they're more worried about outcomes than they are about process, then clearly you've got some buy-in that you got to get there.
And does some of that come through looking at numbers?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have your perception, obviously, but you need the data to support that. And that's not to say that you can't, because most people, when you're making change, John, as you know, they have to get a little bit worse to get a whole lot better. So it's not so much about the numbers today, but it's what are the numbers doing? And you know, can you see that they're trying to make changes? And can you, you know, are those changes eventually paying dividends? And what I found is, with biomechanical efficiency, generally, if you commit to doing it the right way, well, actually not generally, I've seen across the board, when you commit to doing it the right way, where the right way is about effectiveness and efficiency, then it absolutely positively affects performance.
Cool. So it sounds like you have to be in it for the long game. And that's kind of, we were talking about sustainability, and a lot of my favorite coaches that I've admired are people like John Wooden, Greg Popovich, and their programs, you know, are consistent and good over time. And then there's, you know, other programs and coaches that have nice seasons here and there, but can't sustain success. And you've been with so many programs and you've sustained success. So can you give us some more of the insights that, that have helped your philosophy be sustainable?
Yeah, but you guys have got to keep, and I'll do my best, but I only know what I know. You know what I mean? Like I'll tell you what I think it's been about, but please feel free to ask questions along the way.
You know a lot more than us, Hugh, so.
Well, I don't know about that, but I think first of all, it's again, and these terms have become very cliche these days, but it absolutely is a process. And I'm not even sure it's a process where there's an end. I'm not even sure you get to the point where you're like, hey, we've arrived and, you know, we don't have to worry about that. It's something that requires consistent attention and that the commitment you make to being the best you can be, or if you're coaching the national teams, trying to be the best in the world, or on the beach, trying to be the best on the tour, on the FIVB tour, whatever it is, you know, that's not a switch that you flick. You know, that's not a thing that you just do when you choose. That's a habit that you're trying to develop. And so many of these things are about habits of discipline and work and control and, you know, a commitment to yourself and to the team and supporting the goals that people have put out there. And so all of those things kind of contribute to how that culture gets manifested in the day-to-day behaviors. So I don't know how other people do it. But for us, it starts with really trying to clearly identify what we want to be and what's the point, what are we doing here? And once we've figured out what we think it should be about and what behaviors we think we need to support that goal, then all of a sudden we have a standard to hold everyone to, or at least a behavioral expectation to hold everyone to. And then from there, it just comes down to living it every day. And as the leader of a team, you know, whether you like it or not, everybody's watching. And so your ability to live those values or those principles or be true to those, be consistent to those, probably matters as much as anyone's. So it's not about what you expect out of the players. It's almost you've got to understand that we're all in it together and that ultimately, and this is my opinion, I think lots of coaches do this job lots of different ways, but for me, it's about empowering people to be the best that they can be when we need them to be at their best. And that lesson, that journey is a really hard one. There's a lot of inevitable ups and downs, not technically or in terms of systems or whatever, but also just, you know, the emotional growth, the mental game that has to go with it, the capacity for work, all of that stuff matters, and you've got to guide them through that. And the only way you can guide them through that is if you have some knowledge of what it takes to do that, if you have some empathy for the process so that they don't somehow get lost along the way, you keep them connected. And then lastly, you got to know some stuff. You know, you have to have some knowledge of, you know, the game, but also about, you know, the laws of learning or biomechanics or physiology or, you know, or stuff that helps athletes to be good at what they do. So I think it's a lot of stuff that goes into it. So that's why this request for questions is important, because I think it's pretty murky. There's a lot to it. So it's really up to you about what you want to focus on.
Yeah. Well, we've got more questions than answers here. So
okay.
We'll keep firing them at you.
Hopefully. Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
So you've been around some of the people who have committed to being the best they can be. What are some of those habits you've seen that they have? And even if you have specific people or can go in depth, sure, on some of those. Yeah.
Well, the first thing is the decision. You know what I mean? Like, I think, especially in performance, as I said earlier, right? There's no the work is the work, right? There's no magic, and at the end of the day, you're either doing the work or you're not. And to me, the work is not just about putting in the hours, but it's trying to be as effective and efficient as you can be. So how not that's why I never want to talk to people about right and wrong ways of coaching. I just want to talk about how can we do this as effectively and as efficiently so that we can maybe get better at a faster rate. But anyway, back to your point, I think the reason I talk about the decision is because lots of people want to talk about being the best they can be, John. But the reality is it's tough to do that. It's hard. And it's easy to talk about, but it's difficult to do. So, you know, what are you prepared to do to become the best version of yourself in this little part of your life? And I don't think it's about, you know, some kind of sacrifice or anything like that, but I think there's a mindfulness or there's a commitment that gets made with the decision that matters. And on top of that, you have to be working with people that you trust that can help you to get where you want to go. And so there's this decision individually, and then there's almost this connection that with the people that you're working with that allows you to do the work, make the changes, go through the inevitable ebbs and flows and ups and downs to get there. So after the decision comes the work. And like I said, you want someone that guides that you have some faith in, or at least you trust. And in my experience, the currency that makes all of these things work is relationships of trust. If we're talking about, you know, coaches and athletes. And as we know, trust is very difficult to build, and it's very easy to lose. And so, again, going back to that notion of consistency, you know, that matters a lot. And I think as coaches, at least again, the way I see it, I think our job is really as service providers. And it's tempting, I think, for coaches to want to, you know, put themselves in the middle of it, because we do get a lot of control and we do have some influence and power, but that seems irresponsible to me. We want to help these people be the best they can be. That's what we're here to do, to enable their improvement and their development. And so anyway, I think if you're going from that kind of perspective, trust ends up being pretty easy to build, especially if you can teach from a position of positively influencing that person's game. You know, if you can affect change in a good way, if you can help them to be a better hitter, be a better passer, be a better blocker, whatever, then all of a sudden, when you combine the things you're able to do technically with the relationships that you're able to build, then you get into get off a dial up and get onto broadband. You know what I mean? Like all of a sudden all things become possible. And then I'd say the last thing about becoming the best you can be is understanding that it takes a long time. And, again, generally we want to get to a point where we think we're done with the process, but I truly don't think it ever ends. You know, working with players that have been to multiple Olympic games, they were still striving to get better the last day of practice before our season's finished. They were still working on their mental game. They were still working on their reading. They were still working on technical stuff. You know, the beauty, I guess, and the frustration of our sport is that no one's ever played it perfectly. And I think that idea of committing to the process and knowing that I've got to figure out how I can perform or how I can be at my best, even though I may not be feeling my best, even though I may not be at 100%, finding out how to have a good crummy day, how to do all of that stuff. To me, that's what the best people do. They are able to identify, well, first of all, they've made the decision. They want to be great. Second of all, they've learned and they continue to learn what they can about the game and how to play it and how to be effective and efficient. And then they get to this point where their performance is not linked to how they feel. Their performance is linked to being able to stay present and do what you need to do or say what you need to say to give your team the best possible chance of winning the next point. And then when that one's done, getting on to the next one.
Hugh, even approaching this as coaches, let's say we've made the commitment and we know what hard work looks like, putting in the time, the hours. I guess, how in your time have you been more effective and efficient when it comes to being the best coach you can be?
I try to improve. I know lots of people want to read lots of books, and I enjoy reading, but I only want to read a book if someone tells me it's great. What I know is experience is the teacher. And so it's way better to get in your gym and mess around with stuff and try to figure stuff out than it is to read about, you know, how Pat Riley worked, right? Because, and no offense to Pat Riley, obviously a phenomenal coach, right? But at the end of the day, all of us as coaches we have to sell, right? We have to deliver this message. We have to get the buy-in. But to do that, we have to be authentic. We have to be real and true to ourselves. And there's a temptation to kind of be someone else, but, you know, people will smell rat. And so it's not necessarily that the principles of success or the tenets of these high achieving athletes that are, you know, affected by high achieving coaches. It's not that necessarily those things are different, but they get translated through different people, different ways. And so for me to pretend to be Pat Riley would be doing myself and Pat Riley a significant disservice. You know, I can only be me. So I've got to coach in a way that's true to me.
You just don't have the hair, Hugh. I don't know.
I don't have the look. Yeah, man, I wish I could slick it back, but I think that's an important part of it. You know, you got to thine own self be true, right? Shakespeare was right on.
And so you're saying you can't just listen to a podcast on coaching. You actually have to get in the gym.
Well, listen, the podcast is great. No. Because what you hope is that it gets people to think. And that's all we ever want I'm not going to tell anyone what's the right way, what's the wrong way to do it for them. But if they can go through the information that you guys talk about and the principles that you guys talk about on your podcast and look at how they can incorporate that into their coaching philosophy, then it's really adding a ton of value. Now, going back to your original question, yeah, I will read some books from time to time, but I really just try to learn by doing. And I was fortunate enough to work with a lot of great people along the way. So I had a lot of significant mentors that were very influential. And obviously Carl was one of them. I got to play for him, and then we coached together for a long time. And you know, we had a great run, and it was wonderful to be a part of that. But in terms of teaching the game of volleyball, I don't think there was anyone better, at least in terms of constructing a paradigm that allowed us to take all of this research from this world of modal learning that Carl was from, and then bring it into our sport and apply it to coaching. I think that's a wonderful thing. And the great thing about those principles is they give you an evaluative criteria through which to evaluate all the other stuff that's out there, because there's a ton of stuff. And so how do you know what's right or what's wrong? Well, you've got to figure out what resonates with you in terms of the principles that you want to apply. And you learn those principles from your podcast and from books or from hanging out in other people's gyms and seeing what they're doing. And then you get to, you know, apply that through your translation, you know, your efforts and your personality and the things that you believe. Awesome. What do you think? Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense.
All right, good.
You talked about never telling another coach how to coach. It seems like you're flexible, like what works for you. When it comes to your program, does your culture change based on what players you have in a given year? Or is the culture always pretty consistent and it's the players' jobs to adapt?
No, so I'm very much into adaptive leadership. You know, the principles that are driving our coaching methods don't change. But the application of them should change, not in terms of biomechanics or whatever, but certainly in terms of culture and developing leadership and all of that stuff. You know, because especially in the college world, one of the cool things about it is it's not 4 years to be good for 2 weeks to hope to be good for the last 2 hours, like it is in the Olympic world. It's you know, let's go for a year, and then guess what? We get to do it all again next year, and we get to do it all again with different people and different personalities, and those personalities are going to grow and develop and change and as people mature. And so that's kind of a cool thing to be in. So to your point, the idea that we would, you know, get into this, you know, it's my way or the highway kind of thing in terms of how we're going to do this thing, I think that's probably not the best way to connect with people today. I think the idea that for me, as someone in now moderate age, having been around the block once or twice, you know, as long as the principles are being applied, I'm quite flexible in terms of how they get applied. But I would also say that it's still very demanding, regardless of how we get there. The work still has to be done. So the cultural support of getting the work done might look different from year to year, or at least the emphasis from year to year in terms of how the relationships develop or the way you choose to interact with the group or whatever. That might change year to year, but the work doesn't change. You know, you still got to do it, and you still got to do it as effectively and efficiently as possible.
Can you give us an example on how maybe it's changed from 1 year to another based on what you guys were emphasizing?
Sure. Well, each team presents different people, obviously, with different personalities and different histories and different perspectives. So just the way they come together and the way the teams act and interact changes generally from year to year. I tend not to rate it as, you know, a good thing or a bad thing, whatever they're doing. It's just, this is the way this group works. And then within that, their kind of unique operating system, obviously we have some behavioral expectations that we want them to abide by. And then we try to figure out how to connect in terms of you know, how you communicate in practice, or how you, like we talked about, developing leadership or you know, how we're going to lead. Do we have one leader? Do we have a leadership committee? You know, what's the best way to do all of these different things? So from year to year, as people change, I don't know if the culture changes, but the way it's interpreted might.
And what about differences in, say, you know, the national team versus the college program? How is it different implementing the culture there?
Well, you get less time with the national team in some ways, because, you know, you've only got them for a few months a year. And so much of the demands of the international calendar are about performance, and there's no doubt that you need to build a culture that supports that. But it generally, I've found it takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of buy-in. So it's also necessary at the international level to be very, very good for long periods of time. You know, most people that get into that gym were very good in college, or they were very good with their professional club teams. And so, you know, they're no longer kind of big fishes in little ponds. Now they're swimming with all the big fishes. And so there's an expectation in terms of performance outcome. I think, you know, if we're talking about differences between college and the national team, maybe in the Big Ten, you've got to pass a free ball perfectly, I don't know, 9 times out of 10. Maybe if you're going to win a gold medal, you got to do it 99 times out of 100, something like that. A space that seems pretty small, but it's actually really huge. So when you're dealing with national team athletes, you've got a ton of very physical people that have had a lot of success for most of their life that aren't really used to dealing with failure, if we can define biomechanical efficiency as failure. If we can define biomechanical inefficiency as failure. So you have to really try to connect in a lot of different ways. And like I said, you don't have a ton of time to do that. So, I mean, you know, you end up traveling a lot to go have a cup of coffee with someone in Italy or Turkey or or whatever, to just to try to I don't know, have those kind of authentic moments one-on-one, knowing that most of the time that you're going to get in the gym, you have to work on getting better at volleyball, because it's like I said, 4 years to hope to be good for 2 weeks to hope to be good for the last 2 hours. And that's the whole thing that's driving it. And so performance is a big deal. When you get to be on in the college ranks, and again, I can only speak for, you know, how we go about doing it, but it seems that our responsibility should be greater than just trying to win a gold medal, that we really should be about a much more holistic approach to athlete development, that I think we need to obviously be about competitive excellence. We need to be good 9 times out of 10, but, you know, we also have to get it done in the classroom. We have to have our kids graduate. And then I think we have a responsibility to help them to, I don't know, for want of a better term, grow up or mature or evolve during a pretty formative time in their life, and try to help them navigate all of that stuff as well. So I think those are the, you know, some of the bigger differences there.
You're in a unique position, having had so much success with both the men's and women's national team programs. Is your approach different between men and women when it comes to culture or how you coach in general?
You know, the big thing to tell you is that there are way more similarities than differences. And I think one of the things I derive a lot of satisfaction from is taking the methodology that we were using with the men's national team and working to try to implement that with the women and having it be successful. You know, we were swing blocking and run and goes and bics and d's and playing volleyball, and we're getting off this whole idea that you know, we've got men's volleyball and women's volleyball. We've just got volleyball. So that was the first thing. We, you know, we're all human. We live on planet Earth. The laws of physics apply. So we play in a sport where they have some changes in the constraints due to the difference in you know, power and height between the genders. So you know, Clay Stanley was touching over 12 feet and was able to jump high and hit hard, but you know, the net was at 8 foot, but the women's net is whatever, 7'4" and change, and you know, Feluca was touching over 11 foot and she was able to jump high and hit hard too, so it didn't really matter. You know, we could still do the stuff we wanted to do. I think the biggest systemic difference between the two is obviously a little more slide in the 4-2, although there were a few teams, Cuba, Brazil, a few teams along the way tried to have some of their guys running off of 1 foot behind, and it was fine. But that's probably the biggest difference. In terms of the culture piece, I think, you know, connecting and communicating were quite different. And I get it. I'm a male talking about gender difference in sports, so I don't profess to be the definitive answer on all of this. But in my experience, certainly, you know, to connect with the guys, it was a lot about chipping through the armor and really trying to get them to be vulnerable enough to make change by kind of pushing through the ego a little bit. Whereas for the female athletes, it was a little more, you know, almost trying to make them understand how good they were. You know, there's a little more fear and insecurity there. And when you look at the socialization of men and women, I think it's fair to say, you know, you can understand that, you know, the media content that's aimed towards women is seldom, you know, empowering and all the rest of it. It's more about, you know, let's create an insecurity and lo and behold, we have a product that will help you with that. So, that's kind of the main thing. And I think communicating with them different as well, just, you know, the guys, there's a little more directness that can be there. I think with female athletes, it needed to be a little more nuanced.
I was thinking about more of the tactical differences with men and women. And it seems like now most of the top women's teams in the world are jump floating, and still in the men's game, there's a heavy amount of jump servers.
Yeah. to the men's game, I was just going to say, I think, and it's not, I don't think it's a particularly good thing that the men's, you know, because we're missing 30% of our serves. It doesn't make for a great game to watch. But anyway, continue with your question.
No, yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like if you were going to take a men's college team right now or the men's national team, do you think you would go with six jump floaters, seeing how effective a serve it is?
Well, the reason you jump float in women's volleyball is because the lower net makes it easier to fire that thing in. You know, I mean, you can hit a 42-mile-an-hour jump float or a 45-mile-an-hour jump float, and it's gnarly. And I get it. Sometimes you got to ease up so you get more movement and hit it a little bit different speeds, but you can do that. And I think as you look at the men's game, I understand that there's great risk-reward on the jump serve side of things, but I think the numbers, and it's been a while now, but, you know, in 2008, I think we missed around 12 or 14% of our serves. And that was a pretty good team. And Clay got a green light, you know, and he could, if it was a good toss, Clay, you hit it as hard as you can. And Reed got a green light. And Loy and Riley, their job was to hit it in a lot. And Ryan and David Lee never got to miss. You know, that was it. And having a combined serving strategy of here's a number that we think we can get to, I think worked well for that group. But it wasn't about this individual server. It was about all of the servers and how we were going to try to, you know, attack things as a group. So if I were coaching men today, I still think you could figure out a way to hit it in a lot more. And I get it. Offenses are fast and back row attacks are real and the quick bick is a big deal. And the premium on knocking teams out of system is huge. But that particular group was pretty good at blocking and defending. And so we wanted to play to that advantage.
Cool. And then going back to the women's jump float for you guys at Minnesota, do you guys value velocity or movement more as one talked about more, or one you guys strive to get more of?
Probably more accuracy. You know, we want to hit a good serve in the court often, of course, but finding the right person, getting in the right seam, that seems to be a bigger deal. And I think that's just because, you know, internationally the patterns are still there and the inefficiencies are still there, but they're not generally as strong as they might be in college.
Cool. Okay. Well, back to culture. We got a couple more on that.
Well, just one more thing.
No, go ahead.
You know,
sorry.
With the 2012 team, we had a couple of people jump spinning, and I thought that was great. And at Minnesota, we've had an athlete that was a jump spin server, and so I'm not opposed to it. I think again, you got to build systems that are about the personnel that you have. So if we had someone that we thought could be effective and generate points from the service line, but jump spinning, I would certainly look to it. I don't shy away from it, but I do understand that because the side out point scoring numbers are a little bit different in women's volleyball, you know, hitting it in probably matters a little bit more.
Yeah. And maybe this question will maybe reflect why you choose to have a jump spinner. I'm wondering if that's based on numbers or why that is decided. But basically my question is your culture more of an art or is it more of a science?
Yeah, it's both. And here's the reason. You know, the art of it is getting to know people and allowing them to get to know you and building trust and trying to prove through the consistency of action that you're an advocate, that you're there to help, that you're trying to do everything you can to allow them to be the best that they can be. And also have them understand that even though they're investing in their development individually, that coaches also have a greater responsibility to the team to try to help the team be successful and honor their goals as well. And sometimes those commitments are in conflict. So that's the art piece, is the people piece, managing everybody and trying to figure out you know, what needs to happen when. The science bit of it is that, again, most people want to be a part of a volleyball team because they want to be a part of something successful, or they want to be a part of something greater than themselves. I would imagine if they didn't, they'd be playing golf or tennis or something. So there's also this responsibility to be about it, competitive excellence and the success that goes with that. So to do that, you have to look for efficient teaching methods, and you have to look for the right systems for the group that you have, and you have to put the right people in the right places and make the right subs at the right time and do all of that stuff that needs some probably intuition as well, but mainly it needs a lot of quantitative support for a lot of those decisions. So yeah, it needs both.
I like it.
Hugh, what is the best culture you've ever observed? What comes to mind, and what does it look like?
I think the 2008 group, the last 8 months were pretty special with that group. I think the thing I liked most, the reason I'm pausing a little bit is I'm trying to find concrete examples of behaviors that really exhibited this, but there was a very large degree of selflessness in that group and a very strong commitment to each other and to the goals, even though, like all teams, we weren't all best friends. It's not like we got done with practice and, you know, we all hugged it out. I mean, we were competing and everyone wanted to play, but more importantly, it wasn't about anyone necessarily getting theirs. It was about us getting ours. So that team was pretty special. And I think about, especially into the Olympics and the way they managed, all of the moments that went with that and their performance on the court, it was remarkable. And it just made me believe that our culture had kind of become what we'd all hoped it could be. And I say that because in 2005, we put together a mission statement, and not all teams are capable of missions. We know that some teams can just do some expectations and some teams can just abide by some values, but this team had some depth and some maturity, so we got into a mission and we're trying to figure out what the goal should be in 2005. And very clearly I remember talking about the fact that that it seemed really important that the goal was to win the Olympic Games, or how about this, I think we actually framed it to be the best we could be with the hope of winning the Olympic Games. And there was a lot of strong uncomfortableness or opposition almost to that notion, because we all knew how tough it was to even qualify for the game. So talking about winning it seemed a bit crass, you know, a bit pie in the sky. And my rationale for that was, first of all, we're the U.S. team, so it just seems really culturally wrong for us to say, hey, we're really hoping to be the fifth best team in the world, right? That's not what America is about. We're trying to be number one. But more importantly, if we didn't commit to trying to win the thing, if we weren't going to be about trying to be the best in the world, then what were we doing? You know, like, I get it. We might get to the end and we might not win, but at least if we say and do everything we can to be the best we can be, then we'll know at the end that we were good enough or we weren't, but we're going to sleep fine either way. You know, if we don't win it, well, it'll sting a bit. But at least we did everything we could. And that idea of nobility of best effort was really the thing driving this goal in 2005. So anyway, luckily we were able to all agree that that was worth putting in the mission. And then there were some behaviors that went with it and some other things that we were all going to hold ourselves to. And when we got to 2008 and the way that team played, it seemed that every word we'd put into that document in 2005 was being exhibited, was being lived, was being exemplified by the performance in Beijing. And that was profoundly satisfying. And of course, we got the result as well, but that seemed more like you know, good gravy than it did, like, that was the validation. Just seeing the way they went about it was a very, very satisfying thing for me. It was a great thing to be a part of.
Cool. And speaking of this particular team, we have a listener question from a one Mr. Rich Lamborn. He asks, how did you stay the course in 06 after all the turmoil and a disappointing year the year before?
Well, in 2006, we got 10th at the World Championships, and it was a mess. In 2005, we'd had a really good year, I think surprisingly good for most. One of the things we got to do, we got to go down to Brazil and play in this America's Cup event. I don't know if they still have it, because we ended up beating them a couple of times and they weren't too happy about it. But we ended up beating Brazil in five in Brazil, and it was the team that had won the gold medal in Athens. It was that same crew. So that was a big win. And we went away after 2005. We took a silver in Grand Champions Cup, and you know, I think everyone thought we were pretty good. And basically, in my estimation, most of the people on the team thought they were the reason why the team was very successful. And so when we came into 2006, one, we had a ton of injuries, but also the disease of me was fairly rampant. And as we got into 2006, like I said, we had some injuries. And so when we were getting into selecting that team, we really weren't in a position to pick the best team, because the way the calendar worked then, we were playing into November. So teams, athletes had gone away from the training center and they'd moved to their clubs, and we all had to bring them back. So we were kind of selecting it as kind of an all-star crew off of paper. And we got them there, and the tournament was good. We got into some tough pools, and I don't know, we lost a couple of matches, and all of a sudden got pretty exciting. We ended up getting 10th, right? And we bottomed out. I think that's fair to say. So what happens next is the question. I get it, but I think the question needed a little context, because it's been a while. In my opinion, before you can slay the beast, you got to know what you're fighting. And as tough as it was to get 10th in that World Championship event, we learned a ton, or I learned a ton, about what were the issues that were this team needed to address, and what were the things that were some of the motives that were driving people that needed to change, and where we could affect the biggest opportunities for improvement. And so what we did is we got to work. You know, it was feedback. It wasn't failure. You know, the goal is to be good at the end of it. And as much as you want to be good in the middle, you know, the USOC is supplying financial support for medals. And we got to work. The first thing, I was deeply hurt by the tournament in terms of, like, what could I have done wrong? Or what could I have done better? What did I do wrong? How can we make this better? And, you know, there's lots of mornings when you're trying to be the best in the world that you wake up at 4 a.m. thinking, what the hell are we doing? And there was a lot of that. And so instead of trying to address it all as one big issue, I was just going to piecemeal this thing out slowly. And I would just send out these little team emails once every couple of weeks. And it was kind of open to respond if you wanted to respond. I'm sure initially the guys were like, what the hell is he doing clogging up my inbox, you know? But basically I would take one moment that I thought was, you know, a moment of dysfunction or a moment of inappropriate behavior or that wasn't aligned with our goals or our mission. And I would explain what the event was, why it was, inappropriate, I guess, for want of a better term, but why it was counter to our goals and our values, and what needed to happen moving forward, why this needed to change. And then here was this other thing, and here's this other thing. And slowly, maybe after the first two or three, now I start getting some responses. And then by the time I got to, I don't know, email 8 or 9, we got some pretty good exchange. And what that allowed us to do was to set up the framework for what changes need to, to occur moving forward before they got in the gym, so that when they arrived in May, a lot of that stuff had been kind of hashed out, and we were able to basically put all of that to bed and say, hey, okay, it was tough, but there's a ton of lessons learned, and now let's get back to work, kind of thing. And that's how it happened, I think. We went to World League and had a nice finish. We got a bronze medal in World League, and then Lloyd ended up joining the team, and we ended up winning that America's Cup thing in five again. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're getting some mojo. But that's how we did it, is we just got to work. And it sucks losing, and it hurts, and it's not cool at all. But I generally find that, first of all, when you're winning all the time, that can mask a lot of problems. And when you lose, you generally get everyone's attention. It presents the greatest opportunity for improvement.
Hmm. Well, since we're on this important and interesting era of the sport, I spoke to Reed Pretty a little this morning and asked him if he had a question, and he had one. So he said, it wasn't until after he won the gold medal that he saw how formative and critical the mission statement was. And given all the backlash you received from the players, what gave you the fortitude to stick with it? That's what he was wondering. if you could explain what the mission statement was a little bit, that'd be great too.
I don't know if I have a copy handy. I'll try to remember a few of the things in there. But one of the things that's important as a coach is you really have to believe in what you're doing. I think, I call it belligerent optimism, and you need conviction. Because inevitably there are going to be times where, of course, the players are going to doubt, but maybe your staff will have questions or maybe you will, you know, but you have to believe in what you're doing, which is why this principle-based methodology is so critical, because it gives you these objective criteria for evaluating your methods. It's really important. So what I knew is that the team was pretty good, right? In 2004, we got to the medal round and we got fourth, which is heartbreaking, no question. But I think had anyone said going into that tournament, hey, you're going to get to the medal round, everyone would have been pretty happy with that. So anyway, that being said, when I took over the team, I knew we had to get better at playing volleyball, but I really thought that looking for a competitive advantage, the best thing we could do was to be the best team in the world. And I'm not necessarily talking about playing the best volleyball. I'm just talking about being the best team, being the best teammates. Because, you know, we weren't going to be faster than Brazil. You know, they were running a third step go at that point, and it was crazy. They were running really fast offense, and we weren't going to be taller than Russia because they had their 7-foot guys in the middle, and we weren't going to be, and we had Millar and Lee, who's, you know, 6'7" and 6'8" or whatever, who, I get it, they're still tall guys, but not when you're matching up against 7'2". And we weren't going to be stronger than Bulgaria or whatever. You know, we just, what was our thing going to be? What were we going to hang our hat on? And it wasn't enough to just, somehow rely on the successes of the past. You know, this team needed to create its own identity, and we needed to create our own hook, our own thing. So the reason I held on to the mission, even though we got some pushback, was because the words in there, the values, were the right things in terms of, you know, we were going to commit to becoming the best we could be individually and collectively. We talked about how we were going to manage the moment of competition, that we were going to be at our best when our best is needed or something like that. I mean, there were all kinds of phrases in there, but there was talk about representing ourselves and our team and our country with honor, you know, and an expectation that we needed to take pride and own the responsibility that we had relative to representing this country. So there were all of those parts that were going into it. So even though I know that it was different than maybe what the guys had experienced before, and it probably sounded very foo-foo and soft and warm and fuzzy, but I had complete belief that without this document, you know, we wouldn't have something to hold everyone accountable to in terms of what the expectation was and how we were going to get there and what the point of it all was. Because I think if you don't know what the point of what you're doing is, then you're never going to get to be any good. You know, so we had the goal, we had the behaviors that were going to support it, and it provided great accountability. And why wouldn't you want that as part of your team?
You mentioned how important relationships are, how it's part of the art of coaching. Do you care if your players like you? How do you find that balance between being liked and pushing them hard? Or I guess, does that even concern you?
I can only control so much in the relationship piece. And I certainly try to be friendly and inclusive and respectful and loyal. But I'm not interested in being friends with our athletes. After they're done, I'm happy to go down that path. But while I'm their coach, I'm their coach. And to me, it's much more important that they listen and that they see me as a credible source of information and that they allow me to try to help them in their journey to become the best they can be versus necessarily liking it and you know, the whole rainbows and ponies thing. I don't get too caught up in that. I think it's natural that we all want to be liked, but I think it's more important to be respected.
Well, I could listen to you for hours and would love to keep learning from you, but you've given us a lot. So we just have one more question, and it's from another listener, Tom Black, who actually recommended this topic to talk to you about, and I think it was a very good pick. So he wants to know, how do you know if you've created a sustainable culture of excellence?
It's a good question. I think instead of talking necessarily about the sustainability of it, I would like to talk about it being a high functioning team. You know, how do you know if your team's high functioning? And I think it's going to be little things. For example, you know, with that 2008 group, at one point we're sitting down at the table in 2008 somewhere, I have no idea, and guys are getting up and asking if anyone needs anything. And they're showing some genuine care and concern for their teammates. That's a good sign. In practice on Friday, a group of going to be seniors are staying after practice and helping some of our incoming freshmen and talking to them about how it works here and what we need to do and how to, you know, what the coaches are trying to say. Those are little things, right? But they speak volumes to what people are about, you know, and so it's those little actions, those little interactions that are consistent with what you've deemed to be the goals and the values that are driving your program. And I know they seem a little bit trite, but those things mean that, for example, the getting up and does anyone need anything, that means that we've affected some kind of bigger change than just how do we get to be good on the volleyball court. That means we're, as I said earlier in this thing, you know, greatness isn't a switch, it's a habit, right? So if we can exhibit changes in behavior outside of the normal realm of volleyball, to me that means that the culture is becoming high functioning, that the team's becoming high functioning.
Awesome. Well, Hugh, thank you so much for all you've shared. We've learned a ton. And I hope the coaches listening will take these insights and go get to work in their gyms.
Hey, it's my pleasure, right? Six people in a ball. How hard could it be, huh?
Well, for us, it's just two people. We got to get you out to the beach working with us. So.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, anytime. I got sent a little video of some footwork, so I'm ready to consult anytime. But listen, you guys, it's a great thing you're doing. It's a great thing you're doing for our sport. And, you know, there are no secrets. I think one of the great things about our sport right now is that everyone's interested in growing it and making it the best we can make it. Because I still think for volleyball, the best is yet to come. And this kind of open exchange of ideas is a wonderful thing. So thanks for having me, and all the best to you both, all right?
Thanks, you. It means a lot. All right. Thanks for your time.
Cheers. See you.
All right. See you. Bye-bye.